But we'll get started with the session. So like I said, Dana Blanchard is here all the way from Chicago. We're very lucky to have her to talk to you today. She works at Haymarket Books, which are the publisher of a lot of wonderful left-wing books, many of which we have on the big bookstall here today. She's actually been a correspondent and a reporter for Socialist Worker, the International Socialist Organization's newspaper, and was reporting this year on the really amazing and inspiring teacher strikes that happened throughout a whole series of states, starting in West Virginia. So make her welcome.
Can everyone hear me okay? Is this all working? Everything's working? Okay. So just to be honest, when the conference organizers asked me to present on organizing perspectives, covering key issues in U.S. politics at the moment, I initially was like, do I have half a day to do this? Just kidding. We're going to do it in one session, but it means I'm going to kind of summarize some things. I cannot possibly cover everything that's going on in U.S. politics and the organizing of the resistance to Trump, but I am going to try to kind of chart a course through some of the key political things that are happening right now in the U.S., but feel free to ask me questions if there's anything I missed that you want to know more about. Feel free to ask me in this session. Also ask me afterwards. I'm here all weekend, so, you know, I'm available. And I'm also going to possibly use some shorthand, refer to people. If you don't know who somebody is or what something is that I'm talking about, just stop me and I'll explain it. So there's a lot of different figures in U.S. politics. I'm going to assume people kind of know what's going on with some of them, but if I miss anything important, please let me know. I want to be as clear as possible, and I know you're all here to kind of get a clearer picture of what's happening in the United States. So the first thing to say after that disclaimer is that the title of this talk is perfect. Trump's America, the Horror and the Hope. As an organizer and activist in the U.S., I can confirm that amidst all the horrors and the daily barrage of nonsense and hate that comes from the White House and the bigots in the streets, there is a real sense of hope on the American left. I've been an organized socialist for 20 years in the United States, and I can honestly say that this moment feels more hopeful for the socialist movement than at any time in my lifetime. So that's real at the same time that we're organizing under, you know, a incredibly bigoted political regime. So it's a dynamic moment in U.S. politics. It's polarized. The far right is growing at the same time as the socialist left is beginning to consolidate its forces. We have Nazis marching in the streets, a white supremacist misogynist as president, a growing gap between rich and poor, racist cops murdering unarmed black men, women and children on the streets, a possible end to what's left of abortion rights in our country. So that's the bleak picture, but that's only half the picture. The Trump agenda has been met with resistance from the very first day of office, massive women's marches, inauguration protests, some of the largest protests in U.S. history, occupations of airports to stop deportations and family separations, mass protests against the far right everywhere they have tried to organize, socialism being discussed in the mainstream media in an unironic, non-Fox News fashion, and the massive growth of the socialist movement, best characterized by the now 50,000 members of the Democratic Socialists of America. So those are two halves of a polarized political picture. I'm going to get to the mostly hopeful part of my presentation a little later on, but I want to start with some of the more horrible and somewhat out of our control stuff because it's best to end on a positive note, I think. So what are the objective circumstances in which we're organizing as socialists in the U.S. right now? In other words, what are the material conditions we face and how do we understand them in order to respond and help build a socialist left? So I want to start with the economy and the labor movement. After almost a decade of low growth and slump, we're actually in an economic boom in the U.S. Corporate profits are through the roof. Companies are seeking to take advantage of it and hiring as much as possible. However, wages are effectively falling because they're not keeping up with inflation at the same time that this is the tightest labor market we've seen since before the recession in 2008. And this has a real effect on people. The teachers in Oklahoma that we interviewed for Socialist Worker were able to risk everything and go out on a basically a wildcat illegal strike because they said they could easily get a job somewhere else. Many had already left for other jobs, and they felt they really had nothing to lose. This is not going to be everyone, of course, and most people are still working several jobs just to make ends meet, but we're already seeing signs of activity in the fall in the labor movement. So 30,000 teachers in Los Angeles are voting to go on strike in early October. It looks very likely. Washington State right now, basically they have a windfall of money that's supposed to go to education that the governor is hoarding. Most of Clark County in Washington State is already on strike. In Seattle, the largest city in Washington, is possibly going out on strike next week. So there is real movement. There's a movement called Red for Med, which is nurses organizing out of the inspiring teacher strikes that are taking on some of the healthcare giants in hospital strikes around the country. And these are the beginnings of some new rumblings in the labor movement. And they're very, very exciting. But it's still too soon to tell where all of this will lead. There's a whole other session where I'm going to speak more about the teachers' resistance. I'm not going to go into any more about that here, but basically going to self-promote and say go to that session if you want to know more about it. Because it's very interesting, and I think it points the way forward for what the labor movement could be doing and should be doing in this moment. So at the same time as people are facing the next round of recession, one that would be devastating for working people who've already seen a massive decline in living standards and no real recovery since 2008, the union movement has also, in addition to seeing these strikes, it's also facing the worst ideological attack in decades in the form of the Supreme Court Janus ruling. Are people familiar with this? So it's the second time, basically, a right-to-work case has made it all the way to the Supreme Court. The last time, Antonin Scalia died, and so it was stalled. So the labor movement technically had a couple more years to figure out what to do about it, and they really didn't. So Janus has passed, and it's made America a right-to-work country, which has basically gutted the resources and membership of large public sector unions mostly, at a time when public sector unions are facing the brunt of the attack. So it's not a good thing. But contradictions are inherent at any period, and this is no exception. Another economic crisis is looming, and it looks like it will be worse than 2008. And there have been a number of strikes in response to this, but the weakness of the labor movement could put a serious damper on some of these developments. So there's possibilities, but there's also real challenges. And that is really the theme of this talk. So you're going to get more of that. There's possibilities and challenges in all areas of our work right now in the United States. So I want to talk a little bit about racism and the rise of the far right. This is also a contradictory situation in some ways. While the increase in racist incidents and sentiment since the Trump election is undeniable, it also represents in many ways a continuity of some of the policies that were put in place under Barack Obama. Yes, the first black president implemented a relatively racist regime in the United States, especially when it came to police brutality and mass incarceration. He did very little in the face of a massive movement, Black Lives Matter, against police brutality. He did basically nothing. So let's not forget Obama was president when Ferguson, the uprising in Ferguson against police brutality happened, when Black Lives Matter started, and when Trayvon Martin was murdered. So while there has been a sharp uptick in explicit racism in the rise of the far right, I would argue that the racism has continued, the structural racism that was started well before Obama has continued in the form of mass incarceration and police brutality. And there is some organizing going on around this, but it is still, like the rest of the left, relatively weak and unorganized. There have been massive protests. Cops have not been jailed or faced charges. People have been videotaped murdering innocent people and gotten away with it. And so, you know, the movement's in a little bit of a crisis in terms of what to do. But it continues to organize, and that's really important work. And in Chicago, we're involved in a lot of Black Lives Matter work. In fact, this Wednesday, when I go back to Chicago, I'll be out protesting outside of Jason Van Dyke, the officer who murdered Laquan McDonald, an unarmed black teenager in Chicago, on videotape, is actually going on trial in Chicago. And while we have no illusions that he'll be convicted, we're going to pressure them to make it as politically untenable as possible to let him get away with it. So there is a lot of organizing around that in Chicago right now. So the attack on women's rights, this is another. So remember, I'm going through the horrible part first. gets better. As we gather here, Trump is in the process of pushing through the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court in order to create an utterly conservative court and push through a number of anti-worker, anti-women, anti-people of color measures, anti-LGBTQ. First on the docket has been rumblings about overturning Roe v. Wade, the case that legalized abortion after the mass women's rights movement in 1973. So while abortion rights have been undermined and accessibility to abortion procedures is non-existent in more than 80% of counties in the U.S. already, overturning Roe would be the final nail in the coffin of the women's right to bodily autonomy and reproductive freedom. The stakes are very high. If Roe is overturned by the Supreme Court, individual states, along with Congress, will be authorized to issue new abortion bans, something they've been trying to do in many conservatively controlled states already. While states that already have abortion bans will be allowed to fully enforce them. One such measure now working its way through the courts is an Iowa ban on abortion that once a fetal heartbeat is detected at roughly 6 weeks of pregnancy, that's medically when that happens, that it is illegal to have an abortion. So that is already on the docket should Roe v. Wade get overturned. This law is intended by anti-choice forces to pose a direct challenge to Roe if and when it reaches the Supreme Court. Like the Janus case, this has been in the works for years. The right has been organizing these cases and waiting for an opportunity to bring it to a Supreme Court that would be friendly to their cause and where they're assured of winning in terms of the balance of forces. But they haven't taken into account the balance of forces outside of the legal system. The nomination of Kavanaugh has led to an increase in public support for Roe v. Wade, with 71% of Americans, a record high, saying they don't want the landmark pro-choice decision to be overturned. This includes 88% of self-described Democrats and 52% of self-identified Republicans. So it is against the will of the people that Roe v. Wade would be overturned. What this means is that we have an enormous opportunity before us to galvanize a new grassroots pro-choice movement, one unfettered by generations of retreat on the part of existing mainstream pro-choice groups who have traded away abortion rights piece by piece for a seat at the political table that has wielded them nothing but scraps from the Democratic Party. But we have to build it from the bottom up and take a page from the Me Too movement, that we must be unapologetic in our demands and not try to reach compromise with sexist bigots and our political enemies. Rather, we must challenge them using our power of numbers in the streets, not votes in the ballot box or calls to congressional leaders. So that is a real fight that's happening right now. The women's rights movement is in a bit of a crisis, but there is a groundswell, especially of young women who are getting organized. And there's a real chance, I think, to rebuild a grassroots movement. To fight for pro-choice again, Now I want to talk a little bit about U.S. imperialism. So on the global scale, it's worth reminding ourselves the free trade empire of the United States and its global domination that has prevailed for six decades is undergoing major shifts under Trump. Trump's trade wars are intensifying with the recent currency war on Turkey. I don't know if people have been following that. It just seems like we're kind of on the brink of something. When I say we're on the brink of another global recession, I think people probably have been following that. Both political parties in the U.S. are now backing this. This kind of rumblings around the trade war, they're going to reinstitute NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, which basically bottomed out the Mexican economy. So both political parties in the U.S. are now backing all these free trade agreements, and the Democrats often more ardently than the Republicans. The Democrats also more ardently back certain policies around U.S. imperialism because they kind of have to show that they're tough. They also do that with tough-on-crime legislation. They pass some of the worst racist laws around policing and mass incarceration because they get baited from the right that they're not serious about it. And so, really, they're no friend. And on imperialism is another place where the Democrats and Republicans line up almost exactly, especially around Palestine. So Palestine as an issue is one that the U.S. ruling class is 100% agreed not to allow any sort of Palestinian freedom movement to exist. So it's something we on the left in the United States need to get much sharper on. U.S. imperialism, I think, is a real question for the left, kind of like rebuilding the women's rights movement on a more solid grassroots foundation. The question of imperialism has been one that we constantly have to revisit on the left. the emerging socialist movement in the U.S. is largely uninformed about U.S. imperialism. Even many on the left hardly talk about imperialism, give people a pass. I mean, Bernie Sanders hasn't been great on issues of imperialism in Palestine, and there was kind of we just don't talk about that policy in some of his campaign. It certainly doesn't fit within the Democratic Party orbit, so a lot of the debates that people are having about the Democratic Party, imperialism is really one of them that comes up often as a point of contention, and how much we should press the Democratic Party on issues of U.S. imperialism. And that's something that I'm really proud distinguishes us as revolutionary socialists on the left, is that we are principled anti-imperialists, and we don't think that that's just a side issue, but one you have to take on. So now I just want to close the horrible section talking about the Democratic Party. So speaking of principles, or rather lack of principles, I want to end this summary of the political terrain in which we're organizing the U.S. by talking a little bit about the utter swamp that is the Democratic Party. So what have the Democrats done to resist Trump? Essentially nothing. Despite talking tough on opposing Trump, the Democrats have instead decided to put all their efforts into flipping Congress to being democratically controlled in the midterm elections, which are coming in November, which frankly cannot come soon enough because we've been hearing about them for a year and a half. We'll remember in November has been kind of like the drumbeat. What are we doing between now and November has been the question of the movements. Rather than becoming a voice for those who are horrified by Trump and the rise of the far right, the Democratic Party has continued to move further to the middle, running candidates in many election races whose claim is simply, we're not as bad as Trump. We're not child molesters like Roy Moore in Alabama. I don't know if people saw this. Wow, a Democrat won in Alabama. It was the worst Democrat candidate you could find. But he wasn't a child molester, so he won. It's disgusting. It's just not a real opposition. We aren't open Nazis is in some cases, they're running against open Nazis and they're we're not that bad. It's not a real opposition. This may seem rather hyperbolic, but it really has been an utterly pathetic response. In fact, it's led some on the left to question whether the Democratic Party is in crisis because what they're doing makes no sense. I don't think they're in crisis, but I do think they're completely out of touch with what most people in America want. And I don't think they want to be in touch with what most people in America want. Evidenced by the fact that in almost half of American counties in the 2016 presidential election, the winning majority was people who decided to actually not vote for either candidate. So there was a third option, I'm disgusted with both of these candidates. That would have won. So an example of the Democrats' lack of spine, during the recent public outrage over Trump's family separation policies that have literally been locking immigrant children up in cages without their parents, putting babies on buses. They literally have buses that have child seats so they can transport toddlers en masse to detention facilities. And they've been deporting people en masse for no reason other than they've been rounded up by ICE, sometimes outside of their school, outside of their workplace, in their homes, as they go grocery shopping. It's absolutely disgusting. The Democrats have been largely silent. When pressed on this issue in press conferences, leading Democrats like Nancy Pelosi from California said that we all just need to wait till November. There's really nothing we can do now. To say this is completely out of line with a movement that's been calling not only for an end to the family separation policies, but calling to abolish ICE altogether, which is a hugely popular demand, and it'd be great if some Democrats and politicians would actually take it up. Democrats are also missing the incredible urgency and outrage people have over the immigrant attacks, which have led to massive protests around the country. And ultimately, that is what has been able to halt the policies. Hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets to demand an end to these policies has been what actually won it, not the Democrats. Into this space of utter retreat and compromise has arisen a layer of radical democratic socialist candidates pushing Bernie Sanders-type ideas within the Democratic Party line. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, an open socialist from the Bronx with a far-left platform, has sparked a lot of excitement in the U.S. socialist movement. Ocasio-Cortez's primary victory in her New York congressional race is significant for everyone on the left, including those like us who stand for an independent alternative outside of the two-party system. So we're excited by it, even though we stand opposed the tendency that I'm part of stands opposed to running as Democrats. Her victory should inspire anyone who doesn't buy the party line that a radical message will alienate people rather than unite and galvanize them. So the message from the Democrats is like, well, we can't be too radical because we'll offend this like mythical middle America. It's like, actually, if you want to win, you should be more radical. That's what people think. But will she change the Democratic Party or will it change her? We have unfortunately seen signs of the latter already, especially on the issue of Palestine and U.S. imperialism, which were also big blind spots in Bernie Sanders' campaign. Recently, we saw her terrible tweets about John McCain, which is kind of like, you didn't have to say anything about John McCain. Just let it go. He didn't have to praise him as a hero, which sparked a lot of debate on the left. And it is a problem to see someone like John McCain as a hero. Until we have larger social movements outside the Democratic Party, I don't think we'll be able to truly hold any candidates, even ones as refreshing as Cortez, accountable. And it's likely in the face of the political pressure from above that they will have to make many more compromises, as scores of progressive politicians before them have done. As Howard Zinn famously said, it's not who's sitting in the White House, but rather who's sitting in that determines real political power. We need to get to the project of really building that, not relying on shortcuts or political maneuvering inside the Democratic Party, but rather capitalize on the openings for radical politics that exist and begin to build power outside of electoral politics. So that's my argument for what we should be doing. So now I want to talk a little bit about the hopeful part. Where are we on that project? This is the beginning, I think, of a real socialist resistance in the United States. Despite all the terribleness and volatility of the American economic and political system right now, it is important to reiterate that it certainly feels like we are in a new moment. Socialism is being talked about all over the place. And DSA candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are at the center of that discussion, but it's much bigger than them. Like when we do tablings and we talk to people like, what do you think about socialism? People want to talk politics, and they want to talk far-left politics. It's really amazing. Socialism is plastered all over the mainstream media. The Washington Post headline after the pathetic far-right protests this past month in Washington, D.C., was "The Triumph of the Left Over the Nazis." ABC News and CNN were running unedited anti-capitalist propaganda in the form of interviews with socialists, many of whom were in my organization. It was a little bizarre to see, like, our banner and our members on CNN, but it's like, that was also kind of awesome. So while there's some real limitations on this, it's an exciting time to be a socialist in America, and the prospects for rebuilding a genuine Marxist current in the U.S. are greater than they have been in my lifetime. So this radicalization has been a long time coming. It's ultimately the result of the financial crisis, I think, of 2007, 2008. Since then, there have been some real rumblings on the American left. 2011, 2014, 2011 with the Occupy movement. 2014, Trump coming to office and the Bernie Sanders campaign popularizing the ideas of socialism for millions of people. So what's happening in the U.S. is also part of a global trend. The inability of the political center to provide a solution to the problems of capitalism that actually does anything for working people, the rise of the far right around the world, and the halting attempts of the left to chart a path forward. I think these are common things that we could talk about in relation to Australian politics, European politics, everywhere around the world. I think this kind of inability of the political center to provide a solution to the vast problems that exist and openings for both the far right and the far left to organize in that space, but also a bit of a vacuum. So to give you a picture of why I say this is a volatile period, but also a hopeful one, I want to just close by walking you through the last year of resistance in the U.S., just to give you a sense of what it's like to organize in the U.S. Let's start back in January. At the turn of the year, many, many of us were very demoralized. I'll be honest, like coming into 2018, we were like, we didn't get rid of Trump. We had a year of up and down, but it didn't really feel like we pushed back that much. So the first year of Trump's presidency did not produce some of the sustained movements we had all anticipated when we were out on the streets in the Women's March in 2017. But things began to change and that began to break through the demoralization. The Women's March in 2018 in Chicago had 300,000 people at it. It was even bigger than the one the year before, and it seemed to come out of nowhere. But it didn't come from nowhere. It was the mass expression of the rumblings of the Me Too movement that began in Hollywood and then shook the very foundations of institutional power as women began to speak out against sexual harassment and demand judgment, or demand justice. And that has continued. There's still aspects of the Me Too movement that are continuing to unfold in the United States. It's very exciting. In February 2018, something even more unexpected happened. Teachers and education workers across the entire state of West Virginia went out on strike. Followed by the strike wave and the attacks on immigrants in the late spring, there were massive mobilizations on our side to keep families together. So we have this strike wave that happens, and then right on the heels of that, we have massive immigrant rights protests that happened. And also, there was some real organizing. There was some real organizing to defend Planned Parenthood as well that happened this past year. So just to paint a picture of kind of like starting in January, we're like, what is going to happen? And then February became more hopeful. And then as the spring progressed, there built a series of movements. Just this month, socialists led the organizing efforts and successfully mobilized against the far right in Washington, D.C. and Boston, beating them back and humiliating them this time in a clear victory for our side. So a year after Charlottesville, where it felt like they were gaining ground, they have essentially been pushed back to the margins. This was described as a transformative experience for all who attended. People were literally singing the Internationale in the rain in D.C. in triumph at the end. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment. Young people in the United States are at the center of this resistance and radicalization. The current generation of high school students have participated in more protests than any generation since the Civil Rights Movement. So that's what we're looking at in terms of the possibilities. So in conclusion, we're in a period of political volatility, polarization, and dynamism. And the last 2 years have witnessed periods of deep demoralization, punctuated by spectacular struggles like the teacher strike wave and the numerous coordinated national protests against the very worst aspects of Trump's regime. That volatility is driving a palpable radicalization among a whole generation of people. There are tremendous opportunities to build the forces of a revolutionary socialist movement in the U.S. right now and as part of a larger, broader radicalization. Socialism is all over the news. It's being discussed by working people and students in our movements, workplaces, and on the streets. I'm wrapping up. While at the same time, the left is still largely disorganized. And we're just at the beginning of something, something that is still mostly ideological and has yet to find a sustained organizational expression, thus its unevenness. The growth of the DSA, for example, is an important reflection of a radicalization that is far wider and deeper than any one organization. We are only at the beginning of a process in which the radicalization will develop through struggle, crystallize into organizations, and cohere into clear political tendencies. That's the hopeful part. Whether the radicalization emerging out of this will be choked off or blossom and spread is still yet to be determined. As a socialist, I'm excited to play a role in that process, to be part of it, and to fight for the emerging socialist movement to take root and to flower. Thank you.